Hello, and welcome to a SearchNetworking.com podcast. You are listening to an audio recording of Securing Wireless Systems, Chapter 9 of the book Build Your Own Security Lab, a Field Guide for Network Testing. The book is written by enterprise security expert Michael Gregg for IT professionals who need to test the security of their networks. This specific chapter discusses the basics of wireless networking and goes on to describe the various methods used to attack and secure wireless systems.
Chapter 9, Securing Wireless Systems. Ever hear the saying, the more things change, the more things stay the same? Consider the not-too-distant past when people used modems and dial-up accounts. During this time, war dialing became very popular. Programs like TuneLock and Scan were popular. Hackers of the time would call ranges of phone numbers looking for systems with modems tied to them. Administrators fought back by limiting the hours that modems were on, started using callback systems, and added caller ID. Then came the move to the early internet. The same methodology of war dialing was carried over to port scanning. The attacker used this newer technology as a way to search for access to a vulnerable system. Administrators were forced to add firewalls, intrusion detection, and filter access to unneeded ports at the edge of the network. Today, many networks have switched to wireless. After all, it's an inexpensive method to add connectivity for local users. Attackers see wireless in the same way that the previous technologies were viewed. Wireless war driving tools can be used to connect to unsecured networks, or tools can be used in an attempt to break weak encryption. Again, administrators must be ready to respond to the threat. This chapter discussing attacking and securing wireless. I start by discussing some basic wireless and then move on to methods used to attack and secure wireless systems. Wireless communication plays a big role in most people's lives, from cell phones to satellite TV to data communication. Most of you probably use a cordless phone at your home and wireless internet at the local coffee shop. Did you ever think about the security of these systems once the information leaves the local device? Your next-door neighbor may be listening to your cordless phone calls with a UHF scanner, or the person next to you at the coffee shop may be sniffing your wireless connection to steal credit card numbers, passwords, or other information. Securing wireless communication is an important aspect of any security professional's duties. Wi-Fi basics. The term wireless can apply to many things, such as cell phones, cordless phones, global positioning systems, AM/FM radio, LAN wireless systems, or WAN wireless systems, to name a few. For the purpose of this book, I am discussing IEEE 802.11 LAN wireless systems, or Wi-Fi. Wireless fidelity, Wi-Fi, is the consumer-friendly name given to the 802.11 family of wireless networking protocols. The idea was to give consumers a more market-friendly name than the technical-sounding 802.11. This family of protocols was created by the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, IEEE. The IEEE also oversees wired versions of Ethernet, such as 802.3. From an equipment standpoint, wireless costs are similar to those of their wired counterparts. The big difference is that there are none of the cable plant costs associated with wired LANs. The cable plant is the physical wires that make up your network infrastructure. Therefore, a business can move into a new or existing facility with cabling and incur none of the usual costs of running a LAN drop to each end user. Although wireless does have its advantages, you need to consider some issues before deciding that wireless is the perfect connectivity solution, including the following. Wired Ethernet is typically faster than most versions of wireless. Obstacles and interference don't affect Ethernet the same way they affect wireless. Wired Ethernet doesn't have a drop in performance the way that wireless does, as long as maximum cable lengths are not exceeded. Wired Ethernet is more secure than wireless in that the attacker must gain access to the physical cable plant. A denial of service attack is also harder to launch in a wired system. Just consider the fact that wireless networks broadcast data through the public airways rather than over network cable. To intercept data on a wired LAN, the intruder must have physical access to the network either by physically connecting over the local Ethernet LAN or by logically connecting over the Internet. Wireless systems make it possible for the attacker to sit in the parking lot across the street and receive the signal. Even if you encrypt the data on your wireless network, the attacker can still sniff it. Before we get too far into the ways in which wireless can be attacked, let's start by discussing some wireless fundamentals, and then we'll move on to wireless attacks, hacking tools, and finally, some ways to secure wireless networks. Wireless clients and NICs. Wireless networks require the client to use a wireless adapter or wireless network interface card, NIC, to connect to the network and communicate with other computers. An access point, or wireless router, can provide internet connectivity to multiple users. A simple wireless LAN consists of two or more computers connected via a wireless connection. No cables or wired connections are required. The computers are connected via wireless NICs that transmit the data over the airwaves. Wireless systems can operate in either ad hoc or infrastructure mode. Ad hoc doesn't need any equipment except wireless network adapters. Ad hoc mode allows a point-to-point type of communication that works well for small networks and is based on a peer-to-peer style of communication. Infrastructure mode makes use of wireless access points. A wireless access point is a centralized wireless device that controls the traffic in the wireless medium. In infrastructure mode, the wireless device communicates with the wireless access point. The wireless access point then forwards the packets to the appropriate computer. If you want to use your wireless-equipped device with a specific wireless access point, it must be configured to use the same service set ID, or SSID. The SSID distinguishes one wireless network from another. The SSID can be up to 32 bits, and it is case-sensitive. It is easily sniffed if it is being broadcast. Overall, if we compare ad hoc wireless networks to infrastructure mode networks, you will see that infrastructure mode is much more scalable. There are some issues with wireless networks that wired networks do not have to worry about. As an example, in a wired network, it's easy for any one of the devices to detect whether another device is transmitting. In a wireless network, the WAP, or wireless access point, hears all the wireless devices, but individual wireless devices cannot hear other wireless devices. This is described as the hidden node problem. To get around this problem, carrier sense multiple access with collision avoidance is used. It functions by having the wireless device listen before it sends a packet. If the wireless device detects that another device is transmitting, it waits for a random period and tries again. If the first wireless device listens and discovers no other device is transmitting, it sends a short message known as ready to send, or RTS. Wireless access points. So far, we have primarily discussed wireless devices and how they can communicate with each other, or the WAP. Let's look at the WAP. The wireless access points can operate in several different modes depending on what you buy and how much money you spend. These modes are as follows. Normal mode, which provides a central point of connection for client wireless devices. Bridge mode, which enables the access point to communicate directly with another access point. This requires that both APs be capable of point-to-point bridging. This technology is useful for extending a wireless LAN between buildings. Client mode. This enables the AP to operate as a network client, communicating with other APs, not with other clients. Repeater mode. This provides a method to repeat access point signal and extend its range. Wireless Communication Standards. Next, let's take a look at some of the popular wireless standards for use with wireless LANs. The first of these protocols to be released was actually 802.11b. The IEEE does not always release these standards in alphabetical order. The 2.4 GHz band is unlicensed and is known as the industrial, scientific, and medical band. When operating, these devices may interfere with 802.11b, 802.11g, or 802.11n communications. The 802.11 family of protocols defines the physical layer standards by which the protocols work. These standards describe the frequency, band, and transmission technology used to access the network and communicate in the defined band. The 802.11b, 802.11g, and 802.11n systems divide the usable spectrum into 14 overlapping staggered channels whose frequency are 5 MHz apart. The channels that are available for use in a particular country differ according to the regulations of that country. As an example, in North America, 11 channels are supported, whereas most European countries support 13 channels. Most wireless devices broadcast by using a spread spectrum technology. This method of transmission transmits data over a wide range of radio frequencies. Spread spectrum lessens noise interference and allows data rates to speed up or slow down depending on the quality of the signal. Spread spectrum is a radio frequencies communication system in which the baseband signal bandwidth is intentionally spread over a larger bandwidth by injecting a higher frequency signal. Thus, energy used in transmitting the signal is spread over a wider bandwidth and appears as noise. This technology was pioneered by the military to make eavesdropping difficult and to increase the difficulty of signal jamming. Currently, the following types of spread spectrum technology exist: direct sequence spread spectrum, or DSSS, frequency hopping spread spectrum, or FHSS, and orthogonal division multiplexing, or ODM. In direct sequence spread spectrum, the method of transmission divides the stream of information to be transmitted into small bits. These bits of data are mapped to a pattern of ratios called a spreading code. The higher the spreading code, the more the signal is resistant to interference, but the less bandwidth is available. The transmitter and the receiver must be synchronized to the same spreading code. In frequency hopping spread spectrum, the method of transmission operates by taking a broad slice of the bandwidth spectrum and dividing it into smaller subchannels of about 1 MHz. The transmitter then hops between subchannels, sending out short bursts of data on each subchannel for a short period of time. This is known as dwell time. For FHSS to work, all communication devices must know the dwell time and must use the same hopping pattern. Because FHSS uses more subchannels than DHSS, it can support more wireless devices. FHSS devices also typically use less power and are the cheaper of the two types. In ODM, the spread spectrum technique uses frequency division multiplexing and distributes data over carriers that are spaced apart at precise frequencies. The spacing provides orthogonally and prevents demodulators from seeing frequencies other than their own. The benefits of this technology include resiliency to RF interference and lower multipath distortion. The technology is sometimes called multi-carrier or discrete multi-tone modulation. The technique is used for digital TV in Europe, Japan, and Australia. Bluetooth basics. A review of wireless basics would not be complete without some mention of Bluetooth. This is another technology you will most likely come into contact with. Bluetooth is a wireless personal area network, or PAN, technology developed by the Bluetooth Special Interest Group. The Bluetooth technology was originally conceived by Ericsson to be a standard for small, cheap, radio-type devices that would replace cables and allow for short-range communication. Bluetooth technology enables users to connect many different devices simply and easily without cables. It was named after Harald Bluetooth, King of Denmark, in the late 900s, and it's used specifically to provide a peer-to-peer service to cellular phones, laptops, handheld computers, digital cameras, printers, and the like. It uses FHSS technology and hops 1,600 times per second among 79 RF channels. By the mid-1990s, the technology started to grow, and by 2000, its usage has become much more widespread. The three classifications of Bluetooth are as follows. Class 1. This has the longest range, up to 100 meters, and has 100 milliwatts of power. Class 2. Although not the most popular, it allows transmission up to 20 meters and has 2.5 milliwatts of power. And Class 3. This is the most widely implemented and supports a transmission distance of 10 meters and has 1 milliwatt of power. The IEEE group for Bluetooth is 802.15.1. Bluetooth operates at the 2.45 GHz frequency. Bluetooth divides the bandwidth into narrow channels to avoid interference with other devices that utilize the same frequency. Wi-Fi security. Wired and wireless networks are very different from a security standpoint. First, on a wired network, the user must gain some access to the physical wire or connector. Second, the network card must be connected to the network. Finally, there is the issue of authentication. Most networks require a user to authenticate himself or herself with a password, token, or biometric, or a combination of these. On a wireless network, these issues were initially overlooked in the first wireless security standard, Wired Equivalent Privacy, or WEP. Wired Equivalent Privacy. WEP was designed to provide the same privacy that a user would have on a wired network. WEP is based on the RC4 Symmetric Encryption Standard and uses either a 64-bit or 128-bit key. WEP's security issue actually begins here because the entire 64 or 128-bit key is not used for encryption, and 24 bits of this key are actually peeled off for use as an initialization vector, or IV. The purpose of the IV is to encrypt each packet with a different key. This is accomplished by adding the IV to the 40-bit or 104-bit pre-shared key, or PSK. The result is IV plus PSK. This also has reduced the effective key strength of the process because the effective lengths of the keys are now only 40 or 104 bits. There are two ways to generate the use of PSK. First, the default key method shares a set of up to four default keys with all of the wireless access points. Second is the key mapping method, which sets up a key mapping relationship for each wireless station with another individual station. Although slightly more secure, this method is more work. It adds overhead and reduces throughput somewhat. This overhead means many systems that use WEP opt to use a single shared key on all stations. To better understand the WEP process, you need to understand the basics of Boolean logic. Specifically, you need to understand how XO-ring exclusive OR works. XO-ring is just a simple binary comparison between two bits that produce another bit as a result of the XO-ring process. When the two bits are compared, XO-ring looks to see whether they differ. If the answer is yes, the resulting output is a 1. If the two bits are the same, the result is a zero. To better understand this process and to understand how WEP functions, let's look at the 7 steps for encrypting a message. First, the transmitting and receiving stations are initialized with a secret key. This secret key must be distributed by using an out-of-band mechanism such as email, posting it on a website, or giving it to you on a piece of paper, as many hotels do. Second, the transmitting station produces a seed, which is obtained by appending the 40-bit secret key to the 24-bit IV for input into a pseudo-random number generator, or PRNG. Third, the transmitting station inputs the seed of the WEP PRNG to generate a key stream of random byte. Fourth, the key stream is XOR'd with plain text to obtain the ciphertext. Fifth, the transmitting station appends the ciphertext to the IV and sets a bit that indicates that it is a WEP encrypted packet. This completes WEP encapsulation, and the results are transmitted as a frame of data. WEP encrypts only the data. The header and trailer are sent in clear text. In the 6th step, the receiving station checks to see whether the encrypted bit of the frame it received is set. If so, the receiving station extracts the IV from the frame and appends the IV to the secret key. And finally, in step 7, the receiver generates a key stream that must match the transmitting station's key. This key stream is XOR'd with the ciphertext to obtain the sent plain text. The big problem with WEP is that the IVs are not exclusive and are reused. This results in a big vulnerability in that the reused IVs expose the PSK. To demonstrate this better, consider the following. Let's assume that our PSK is 876-5309. This value would be merged with QRS to create the secret key of QRS 876-5309. This value would be used to encrypt a packet. The next packet would require a new IV. Therefore, it would still use the PSK 876-5309, but this time it would concatenate it with the value MNO to create a new secret key of MNO 876-5309. This would continue for each packet of data created. This should help you realize that changing part of the secret key is the IV, and that's what WEP cracking is interested in. A busy AP that sends a constant flow of traffic will actually use up all the possible IVs after 5 or 6 hours. Once someone can capture enough packets so that he has reused keys, WEP can be cracked. Tools such as WEP Crack and AirSnort were created for just this purpose. While wireless vendors did work to remove weak IVs, attackers were looking for other ways to crack the encryption standard. In August 2004, a hacker named Korg K released a new piece of attack code that sped up WEP key recovery by nearly 2 orders of magnitude. Instead of using the passive approach to collecting millions of packets to crack the WEP key, his concept was to actively inject packets into the network. This idea is to solicit a response from legitimate devices on the wireless LAN. Even though the hacker can't decipher these packets in their encrypted form, he can guess what they are and use them in a way to provoke additional traffic generating responses. This makes it possible to crack WEP in less than 10 minutes on many wireless networks. With these issues on everyone's mind, the IEEE knew that a new encryption standard would be needed. After all, WEP did not even ensure the authenticity of the data packets. Wi-Fi protected access. The task force assigned to address the growing security needs of wireless users is 802.11i. They were challenged not only to develop a long-term standard, but also to develop something that could be used to secure wireless systems quickly. To meet these two demands, Wi-Fi Protected Access, or WPA, was developed as a short-term solution. WPA delivers a level of security way beyond what WEP offers. WPA uses Temporal Key Integrity Protocol, or TKIP. TKIP scrambles the keys using a hashing algorithm and adds the integrity checking feature that verifies that the key hasn't been tampered with. WPA improves on WEP by increasing the IV from 24-bit to 48. Rollover has also been eliminated, which means key reuse is less likely to occur. WPA also avoids another weakness of WEP by using a different secret key for each packet. Another improvement in WPA is message integrity. WPA addresses a message integrity check, or MIC, that is known as MICAL. MICAL is designed to detect invalid packets and can even take measures to prevent attacks. Best of all, WPA is backward compatible and can work with the RC4 algorithm. This enables users to upgrade existing hardware that may not be able to work with more intense cryptographic algorithms. In 2004, the long-term solution to wireless security was approved with the release of WPA2. This is a standard that the 802.11i group has been working toward. It was designed to use the Advanced Encryption Standard, or AES. AES requires much more processing power than RC4, which was included with the original 802.11 design. Key sizes of up to 256 bits are now available, which is a vast improvement over the original 40-bit encryption WEP used. WPA and WPA2 can use a variety of secure protocols, such as counter mode with cipher block chaining message authentication code protocol, or CCMP. CCMP is based on the AES encryption algorithm. It expands the IV to 48 bits to prevent rollover and detects replayed traffic. Another WPA authentication protocol is Extensible Authentication Protocol, or EAP. EAP is an authentication framework, not an authentication mechanism. EAP rides on top of the Ethernet protocol to facilitate authentication between the client requesting to be authenticated and the server performing the authenticating. There is also EAP over LAN, or EAPOL, which the IEEE approved as a transmission method to move packets from the client to the authentication server. There are four basic types of EOPOL packets. First, EAPOL packet. This message type is simply a container for transporting EAP packets across a LAN. Next is the EAPOL start. This message is used by the client to inform the authenticator it wants to authenticate to the network. Next is the EAPOL logoff. This message informs the authenticator that the client is leaving the network. And finally, the EAPOL key. This message type is used with 802.1x for key distribution. Finally, there is the Temporal Key Integrity Protocol, or TKIP. TKIP is used to address the known cipher attack vulnerability that WEP was vulnerable to. TKIP's role is to ensure each data packet is sent with its own unique encryption key. TKIP uses the RC4 algorithm. 802.1x authentication. 802.1x provides port-based access control. When used in conjunction with EAP, it can be used as a means to authenticate devices that attempt to connect to a specific LAN port. Although EAP was designed for the wired world, it is being bundled with WPA as a means of communicating authentication information and encryption keys between a client or supplicant and an access control server such as Radius. In wireless networks, EAP works as follows. 1. The WAP requests authentication information from the client. 2. The user then supplies the requested authentication information. 3. The WAP then forwards the client-supplied authentication information to a standard Radius server for authentication and authorization. And 4. The client is allowed to connect and transmit data upon authorization from the Radius server. There are other ways that EAP can be used depending on its implementation. Password, digital certificates, and token cards are the most common forms of authentication used. EAP can be deployed as EAP-MD5, Cisco Lightweight EAP, EAP with Transport Layer Security, or EAP with Tunneled TLS. Wireless LAN threats. Wireless networks are open to a number of threats that you may not ever even consider on a wired network. This section discusses some of the attacks that can be launched against a wireless LAN. These include wardriving, eavesdropping, rogue APs, and denial of service attacks. Wardriving. Wardriving is the term used to describe someone who uses a laptop and a wireless NIC to look for wireless networks. The entire act of searching for wireless networks has created some unique activities such as the following. Wardriving. The act of finding and marking the locations and status of wireless networks. This activity is usually performed by automobile. The wardriver typically uses a GPS device to record the location and a discovery tool such as NetStumbler. War chalking. The act of marking buildings or sidewalks with chalk to show others where it's possible to access an exposed company's wireless network. War flying. Similar to war driving, except that a plane is used rather than a car. One of the first publicized acts occurred in the San Francisco area. As you can see, the concepts are pretty simple. Move from place to place and look for wireless networks. If the war driver has a GPS attached to his laptop or handheld device, all he needs to do is log this data, and over time he can start to assemble a database of networks and their location. On the surface, there may not be anything illegal with someone searching for and finding wireless networks. The real concern is what comes next. Piggybacking is the first issue that comes to mind. Just like addicts need a fix, some people need internet access. It might be the guy across the hall at the apartment building who just doesn't have the cash for his own internet access, or it could be the road warrior who needs to check his email and feels he just can't wait till he gets home or back to the office. The second group of people to be concerned with are wireless hackers who would like to use the organization's wireless connection to gain access to its resources. These individuals want to access sensitive information, gain top secret data, or crash a critical system. Although not everyone scanning for wireless networks is trying to cause damage or harm to your company's computers, it is something to be concerned about. NetStumbler. One of the primary tools used to locate wireless networks is NetStumbler. You can download the program from www.netstumbler.com. NetStumbler is a Windows-based GUI tool that you can use as a wireless scanner. It operates by sending a steady stream of broadcast packets on all channels. It's useful for checking the coverage of an organization's wireless LAN. NetStumbler can provide the user with a wealth of information, such as MAC address, SSID, access point name, channel, vendor, security, signal strength, GPS coordinates, and Mini Stumbler is a version of the software that is available for handheld devices. Using NetStumbler is rather straightforward. Just download and install the program onto a laptop computer that has a wireless NIC. The most common type of wireless card that is used is one that has an attachment for an external antenna. Cards such as Pro, Exum, and Cisco are popular because both have jacks for external antennas. Using an external antenna allows the attacker to extend the range and to use either a focused directional antenna or an omnidirectional magnetic-based antenna that can be mounted easily to the roof of a car. This allows the war driver to easily move around looking for WAPs. NetStumbler works by sending probe request frames that cause APs to respond with information about themselves. The normal operation of a WAP is for it to transmit beacons about 10 times a second. The beacons provide information on time, capabilities, supported rates, and the SSID. If the WAP supports the closed network feature, NetStumbler will not get a response, provided that the WAP does not respond to the probe requesting frames using broadcast SSID. Even if the WAP is in a hidden mode, there are still ways for the attacker to get the SSID. All the attacker has to do is send a spoofed disassociate message. The message simply tells the WAP to dissociate an active station. The spoofed client will then be forced to reassociate with the WAP. To do this, the client cycles through probe requests within a second after the disassociation attack. Backtrack contains the Void 11 tool, which will accomplish just such an attack. This message forces a hidden WAP to reveal its SSID. Kismet. Kismet is an 802.11 Layer 2 wireless network detector that runs on the Linux OS. It is also available on Backtrack or can be downloaded from www.kismetwireless.net. Kismet works with many wireless cards and has a similar functionality to NetStumbler's. Kismet has the following features: detection of NetStumbler clients, Cisco product detection via CDP, IP block detection, hidden SSID decloaking, EtherReal file logging, AirSnort compatible weak key logging, runtime decoding of WEP packets, group and custom naming of SSIDs, multiple clients viewing a single capture stream, graphical mapping of data, manufacturer identification, and detection of default WAP configurations. NetStumbler and Kismet are just two of the tools available for site surveys and war driving activities. Eavesdropping. Eavesdropping is another wireless LAN threat. If a hacker can use NetStumbler or Kismet and find a WAP that is configured with the manufacturer's default configuration, it will likely be a target for the attacker. A WAP with even WEP installed is much less appealing for the person doing a random drive-by. Why spend the time hacking it when so many WAPs are open? Even today, WAPs are still open everywhere. As an example of this, consider the following. On a recent trip to a large West Coast city, I placed my laptop in my backpack and walked about 8 to 10 blocks. Figure 9-6, which is available in our chapter download via PDF, shows the results of the war walk. Notice how only a few of those shown had encryption turned on. Out of 140 WAPs I picked up, fewer than half had any form of encryption turned on. Now, although my war walk was just for statistical purposes, an attacker within range can take the next step and intercept the radio signals from these open WAPs and decode the data being transmitted. Nothing more than a wireless sniffer and the ability to place the wireless NIC into promiscuous mode is required. If the attacker is using an antenna, he can be even further away, which makes these attacks hard to detect and prevent. Anything that is not encrypted is vulnerable to attack. Most computer security is based on passwords. Protocols such as File Transfer Protocol, FTP, Telnet, or Simple Mail Transport Protocol, SMTP, transmit username and password in clear text. These protocols are highly vulnerable. Wireless equipment can be configured for open systems authentication or shared key authentication. Open systems authentication means no authentication is used. A large portion of the wireless equipment sold defaults to this setting. If used in this state, hackers are not only free to sniff traffic on the network, they are free to connect to it and use it as they see fit. If there is a path to the internet, the hacker may use the victim's network as the base of attack. Anyone tracing the IP address will be led back to the victim, not the hacker. Many hotels, business centers, coffee shops, and restaurants provide wireless access with open authentication. In these situations, it is excessively easy for a hacker to gain unauthorized information, hijack resources, or even introduce backdoors onto other systems. Just think about it. One of the first things most users do is check their email. This means that usernames and passwords are being passed over a totally insecure network. Tools such as dsniff, WinSniffer, and KNENable can be used to eavesdrop and capture passwords being passed on an unsecure network. dsniff allows the attacker to focus on one specific type of traffic. dsniff is actually a collection of tools that includes dsniff, file snarf, mail snarf, MSG snarf, URL snarf, and web spy. These tools allow the attacker to passively monitor a network for interesting data such as passwords, email, and file transfers. WinSniffer is a password capture utility that enables network administrators to capture passwords of any network user. WinSniffer can capture and decode FTP, POP3, HTTP, ICQ, SMTP, Telnet, IM, AP, and NNTP usernames and passwords. WinSniffer is a Windows utility that is typically installed on laptops. It can be used by security professionals to audit the network or by attackers to access sensitive information. KNENE is a multi-purpose tool that can perform a variety of tasks, including Windows enumeration, sniffing, and password cracking. KNENable will perform password sniffing and password cracking. The password cracking portion of the program can perform dictionary and brute force cracking and can use pre-computed hash tables. Accounts information import, passwords recovery, brute force passwords cracking, hashes computing. Even if encryption is being used, the Ethernet frame is still transmitted in the clear. Even the wireless LANs using WEP are vulnerable. Tools discussed throughout this chapter can be used to crack WEP. While the deficiencies of WEP were corrected with the WPA protocol, those WAPs still running WEP are vulnerable. Rogue and unauthorized access points. A rogue access point is an unauthorized connection to the corporate network. A Gartner Group report found that 20% of networks have rogue WAPs attached. Two primary threats can occur from rogue and unauthorized WAPs. First, the employee's ability to install unmanaged APs. The ease of use of wireless equipment and the lure of freedom is just too much for some employees to resist. And second, the ability to perform WAP spoofing. The way to prevent and deter rogue WAPs installed by insiders is by building strong policies that dictate harsh punishments for individuals found to have installed rogue WAPs and by performing periodic site surveys. Rogue WAPs may also be installed by outsiders seeking access. These devices pose a serious threat. Many times, these devices are placed near the outside of the building. As an example, the attacker may seek to place a rogue WAP near a window or in a location close to the outside of the building so that he can sit in a parking lot or unsecured outside location and attack the network. The attacker will not want to arouse suspicion, so picking a place that he can sit and not look out of place is important. The attacker will also typically use a low-cost device because the possibility of loss is high. If encryption is already being used on the network, the attacker will most likely also turn encryption on because he doesn't want to arouse suspicion. Site surveys would most likely be looking for unencrypted traffic or anything that looks out of the ordinary. Access point spoofing occurs when the hacker sets up their own rogue WAP near the victim's network or in a public place where the victim might try and connect. If the spoofed WAP has the stronger signal, the victim's computer will choose that spoofed WAP. This puts the attacker right in the middle of all the subsequent transmissions. From this man-in-the-middle position, the attacker may attempt to steal usernames and passwords, or simply monitor traffic. When performed in an open hotspot, this attack is sometimes referred to as the evil twin attack. Host routing is also a potential problem for wireless clients. Both Windows and Linux provide IP forwarding capabilities. Therefore, if a wireless client is connected to both a wired and wireless network at the same time, this may expose the hosts on the trusted wired network to any hosts that connect via the wireless network. Just by a simple misconfiguration, an authorized client may be connected to the wired network while unknowingly having its wireless adapter enabled and connected to an unknown wireless LAN. If hackers can compromise the host machine via the open wireless LAN adapter, they are then positioned to mount an attack against the hosts on the wired network. Denial of service. If all else fails, an attacker can always target a wireless network for a denial of service, or DOS, attack. Although a DOS attack does not get the attacker access, it does render the network unusable or degrade service for legitimate users. These attacks can target a single device or the entire wireless network, or can attempt to render wireless equipment useless. Some common types of wireless DOS attacks are covered next. Authentication flood attack. This type of DOS attack generates a flood of EAPOL messages requesting 802.1x authentication. As a result, the authentication server cannot respond to the flood of authentication requests and consequently fails to return successful connections to valid clients. Deauthentication flood attack. This type of DOS targets an individual client and works by spoofing a deauthenticated frame from the WAP to the victim. The victim's wireless device would attempt to reconnect, so the attack would need to send a stream of deauthentication packets to keep the client out of service. Network jamming attack. This type of DOS targets the entire wireless network. The attacker simply builds or purchases a transmitter to flood the airwaves in the vicinity of a wireless network. A 1,000-watt jammer 300 feet away from a building can jam 50 to 100 feet into the office area. Where would an attacker get such a device? It could actually be built from a microwave oven. At the heart of a microwave oven is a magnetron. Normally, a microwave oven doesn't emit radio signals beyond its shielded cabinet. The magnetron must be modified to be useful, but very little skill is required to make this modification. This type of attack would be dangerous to anyone in the general area of the transmitter, as at high level it would be like placing yourself in a microwave oven. Equipment destruction attack. This type of DOS attack targets the AP. The hijacker uses a high-output transmitter with a directional high-gain antenna to pulse the AP. High-energy RF power will damage electronics in the WAP, resulting in it being permanently out of service. Such high-energy RF guns have been demonstrated to work and cost little to build.
SearchNetworking.com is providing this important information to network professionals so that they can be informed of the tools that hackers could use to try to attack their wireless LANs. It is in our opinion that network professionals need to be proficient in using the tools mentioned in this audio to prevent malicious hackers from threatening their network.
Exploiting wireless networks. Wireless networks can be exploited in many different ways. Previous sections of this chapter have demonstrated some of the ways in which wireless systems are vulnerable. Now, let's look at some specific tools and techniques used to exploit wireless networks. Finding and accessing the network. The first thing that must be done is to find the network. The backtrack disk included with this book has Kismet included. For the Windows users, NetStumbler can also be used. Unless you plan to hold your laptop out the window of your car as you drive around, you also want to make sure to get a good external antenna. Antennas come in two basic types, directional and omnidirectional. A directional antenna can be used in a single direction only, whereas an omnidirectional antenna can receive signals from all directions. If you are unsure of the target's location, an omnidirectional antenna may be the better choice. After locating the target network, you might want to initially use a tool such as Wireshark to get an idea of whether the network is actually using encryption. You should be able to tell this by using Kismet or NetStumbler, but Wireshark may help you determine whether the organization is using MAC filtering. If that is the case, MAC spoofing tools are needed. ChangeMAC is a MAC spoofing tool that can be used to change your computer's MAC address and bypass MAC address filtering. After you have determined whether MAC filtering is being used and what, if any, encryption is present, you can take advantage of several different tools to crack various encryption mechanisms.
Wireless attack tools. There is no shortage of wireless tools for someone building a network security lab. Some of the tools include the following. Mognet. This is an open source Java-based wireless sniffer that was designed for handhelds but will run on other platforms. It performs real-time frame captures and can save and load frames in common formats such as Etherreel and TCP dump. WaveStumbler. This sniffing tool was designed for Linux. It reports basic information about APs such as channel, SSID, and MAC. AeroPeak. This is a Windows-based commercial wireless LAN analyzer that is designed to help security professionals deploy, secure, and troubleshoot wireless LANs. AeroPeak has the functionality to perform site surveys, survey assessments, client troubleshooting, wireless LAN monitoring, remote wireless LAN analysis, and application layer protocol analysis. AirSnort. This is a Linux-based wireless LAN weep cracking tool that recovers encryption keys. AirSnort operates by passively monitoring transmissions and then computing the encryption key when the program captures enough packets. THC WarDrive. This is a Linux tool for mapping WAPs and works with a GPS. AirTraf. This is a packet capture decoding tool for 802.11b wireless networks. This Linux tool gathers and organizes packets and performs bandwidth calculations as well as signal strength analysis on a per wireless node basis. AirSnarf. AirSnarf is a simple rogue WAP setup utility designed to demonstrate how a rogue AP can steal usernames and passwords from public wireless hotspots. AirSnarf was developed and released to demonstrate an inherent vulnerability of public 802.11b hotspots. Snarfing usernames and passwords by confusing users with DNS and HTTP redirects from a competing AP. Exploiting Bluetooth. Bluetooth has also been shown to be vulnerable to attack. One early exploit is bluejacking. Although not a true attack, bluejacking allows an individual to send unsolicited messages over Bluetooth to another Bluetooth device. This can include text, images, or sounds. A second, more damaging type of attack is known as blue snarfing. Blue snarfing is the theft of data, calendar information, or phone book entries. Tools used to attack Bluetooth include these. Red Fang. This is a small proof of concept application used to find undiscoverable Bluetooth devices. Blue Sniff. This is a proof of concept tool for Bluetooth war driving. BTS Scanner. This is a Bluetooth scanning program that can perform inquiry and brute force scans, identify Bluetooth devices that are within range, and export the scan results to a text file and sort the findings. Blue Bug. This is a tool that exports a Bluetooth security loophole on some Bluetooth-enabled cell phones. It allows the unauthorized downloading of phone books and call lists and the sending and reading of SMS messages from the attacked phone. Securing wireless networks. Securing wireless is a challenge, but it can be accomplished. Wireless signals don't stop at the outer walls of your facility. Wireless is accessible by many more individuals than have access to your wired network. Although we look at some specific tools and techniques used to secure wireless, the general principle is the same as those used in a wired network. It is the principle of defense in depth. Defense in depth. Defense in depth is about building many layers of protection, such as the following. Encrypting data so that it is hidden from unauthorized individuals. Limiting access based on least privilege. Providing physical protection and security to the hardware. Using strong authentication to verify the identity of the users who access the network. Employing layers of security controls to limit the damage should one layer of security be overcome. Deploying many layers of security to make it much harder for the attacker to overcome the combined security mechanisms. Changing the default value of the SSID is a good place to start. Another potential security measure that may work, depending on the organization, is to limit access to the wireless network to specific network adapters. Some switches and WAPs can perform MAC filtering. MAC filtering uses the MAC address assigned to each network adapter to enable or block access to the network. Probably one of the easiest ways to increase the security of the network is to retire your WEP devices. No matter what the key length is, WEP is vulnerable. Moving to WPA2 will make a big improvement in the security of your wireless network. If you're serious about building your own network security lab, you'll also want to be proficient at performing site surveys. The goal of a site survey is to gather enough information to determine whether the client has the right number and the placement of APs to provide adequate coverage throughout the facility. It's also important to check and see how far the signal radiates outside of the facility. Finally, you're going to want to do a thorough check of rogue APs. I can't tell you the number of times I have seen APs show up in locations where they should not have been. These are as big a threat as, and perhaps even bigger than, the weak encryption you may have found. A site survey is also useful in detecting interference coming from other sources that could degrade the performance of the wireless network. The six basic steps of a site survey are as follows. 1. Obtain a facility diagram. 2. Visually inspect the facility. 3. Identify user areas. 4. Use site survey tools to determine primary access locations and check that no rogue APs are in use. 5. After the installation of APs, verify their signal strength and range. And 6. Document your findings, update the policy, and inform users of rules regarding wireless connectivity. Misuse detection. Intrusion detection systems, or IDSs, have a long history of use in wired networks to detect misuse and flag possible intrusions and attacks. Because of the increased number of wireless networks, more options are becoming available for wireless intrusion detection. A wireless IDS works much like the wired intrusion detection in that it monitors traffic and can alert the administrator when traffic is found that doesn't match normal usage patterns or when traffic matches a predefined pattern of attack. A wireless IDS can be centralized or decentralized, and it should have a combination of sensors that collect and forward 802.11 data. Wireless attacks are unlike wired attacks in that the hacker is often physically located at or close to the local premise. Some wireless IDS systems can provide a general estimate of the hacker's physical location. Therefore, if alert data is provided quickly, security professionals can catch the hackers while launching the attack. A couple of the commercial wireless IDS products are Air Defense, RogueWatch, and IBM Real Secure Server Sensor, and Wireless Scanner. Those who lack the budget to purchase a commercial product have a number of open source options available, including the following. AirSnare. This will alert you to unfriendly MAC addresses on your network, and it will also alert you to DHCP requests taking place. If AirSnare detects an unfriendly MAC address, you have the option of tracking the MAC addresses, access to IP addresses and ports, or launching EtherRealm upon detection. WIDZ intrusion detection. This is designed to be integrated with Snort or RealSecure. This is used to guard WAPs and monitor for scanning, association floods, and bogus WAPs. Snort Wireless. This is designed to integrate with Snort. It is used to detect rogue APs, ad hoc devices, and NetStumbler activity. Chapter Summary. This chapter examined wireless technologies, wireless vulnerabilities, and wireless exploits. Wireless is a technology that is here to stay, so anyone working in IT or IT security should have a good understanding of how it functions. Every technology typically goes through growing pains and tends to become more secure as it matures. Consider early cordless phones. Most shared a few channels so anyone could take his or her phone mobile and pick up a neighbor's conversation or listen in to someone else from down the block. Modern cordless phones are much more secure. Cell phones have a similar history. Early analog phones were vulnerable to tumbling, cloning, and numerous attacks. These attacks continued until modern digital phones gained market share. Their level of security is much greater than their analog predecessors. Wireless LAN technologies have already made significant strides. Replacing WEP with WPA is a good start. WPA2 is an even better technology. In the future, expect further advances to improve security even more.
SearchNetworking.com is providing this important information to network professionals so that they can be informed of the tools that hackers could use to try to attack their wireless LANs. It is in our opinion that network professionals need to be proficient in using the tools mentioned in this audio to prevent malicious hackers from threatening their network. Thank you for listening to this audio recording of Securing Wireless Systems, excerpted from Michael Gregg's book, Build Your Own Security Lab, A Field Guide for Network Testing. To view a copy of this chapter for references or diagrams, go to searchnetworking.com/securing wireless systems. That's searchnetworking.com/securing wireless systems. Thank you for listening.